everybody. Welcome to the Covert Report with Susan Lindauer. Today we've got a great guest, Tony Gosling, who is a British journalist, an independent journalist who's done some, who has done a yeoman's job protecting the alternative media from annihilation by the corporate media and the BBC. Tony is my go-to guy for finding out what's really going on in the world, as opposed to what the mainstream is projecting to us. And you have, today we're going to have a really great show. We're going to be talking about the Zika virus. We're going to be, and new revelations about the Zika virus coming out of Argentina. We're also going to talk about, a new book, 000, by Saviano, who is an expert on narco trafficking and describes how the city of London has become the most significant hub in the world for money laundering of narco profits. So, Tony, welcome today.
Hi, Susan. It's a real pleasure and a privilege to be invited onto your show. And can I just say, you know, it's so wonderful that you've decided to do what you've done with all the knowledge that you got from your operations at some quite high levels at the UN and other places and Central Intelligence Agency connections, that you've actually decided, rather than to sort of, you know, go down the bars and talk about it and moan about it, to actually take the effort. And I think more people should try and do this, to get the word out there, to actually actively shove the word out there, because we are like you and I, people like you and I are rather like these kind of white blood cells who are going around trying to recover the lies that the sarin gas and the various viruses, yes, in our bloodstream are pumping around the world at the moment with, I think, what is the most incredible propaganda wave really since Joseph Goebbels and Hitler in the 1930s and 1940s, because actually, if you're looking at the real facts, the machine that is now pumping out lies is extremely sophisticated. It's a kind of smiling kind of fascism. I don't know if you've come across Alan Frankovich and his filmmaking work from LA. He was originally Peruvian. He's done some fantastic work on uncovering what the intelligence services are really up to with our money, and sometimes with drug money, of course, as well. But he put it like this. He said that it's like a kind of Rotary Club version of the Gestapo. And that's exactly what we're dealing with. Smiling faces, happy people who happen to sit on boards with a lot of power in various ways. But the institutions that they control are monsters. They are devouring people. They're devouring the planet. They're killing people. They're killing the planet. And the mainstream media really just looks the other way and tends to churn out the propagandized public relations view of things from these same destructive corporations.
Oh, yeah. And I love the analogy to white blood cells. That's what we are. We're fighting the infection. We're fighting the infection. Definitely.
And that's right. And our special relationship, because they go on here all the time about this special relationship with the United States, which is actually between, you know, the Atlanticists, the transatlantic relationship has been over the years pretty pernicious. The Europeans have quite rightly saw Britain as and de Gaulle particularly saying, I don't want Britain in the European Union or whatever it was in those days, the EEC, because they're just a Trojan horse for the Americans. And of course, he's quite right. You know, that's exactly what's been going on. Duncan Campbell, the investigative journalist here, if people haven't come across his work, it's absolutely mind blowing, mostly from the 1980s. He used this term, the unsinkable aircraft carrier, to describe Britain as a kind of vehicle for US power in Europe. And of course, after the Second World War, there was a big struggle immediately started, mostly in Italy, but elsewhere through things like the Gladio operations, to make sure that anybody that was thinking of making alliances with the Soviet Union, moving to the left to vote in communist governments or whoever, left-wing, even socialist governments, would be under attack from the Bilderbergers and the CIA, MI6 and the far right, who really, at the end of the day, their main mission was just to make sure that these big monopolies, massive corporations, cartels were protected and the ordinary people didn't get access to the so-called free market.
Yeah, wow, that is absolutely so true. That's brilliant. Brilliant. Speaking of the market, what about the narco trafficking? I mean, that's really a good place to jump into the fact to Saviano's new book. Tell us about that.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's some brilliant. I haven't actually read the book, but I've read several reviews and excerpts from it. I've just ordered it, actually, only when I spotted that article from Ed Valiami from The Guardian. Now, before we get into that, I'd just like to say a little bit about Ed, because his work has been absolutely brilliant over the years. He's probably the senior, most trusted, most trustworthy journalist at The Guardian, which is, by the way, is a newspaper which is losing still around about £500,000 a week. And we're in this weird situation now, this surreal.
Well, the American side is not aware of our American audience does not know anything about that history. Why are they losing money? What's happening?
Well, they're losing money because hardly anyone is buying newspapers like The Guardian. I mean, people do buy things like The Sun, which is, you know, very down market propaganda rag of Rupert Murdoch's. And they'll maybe buy things like the Daily Mirror, which are, again, as a tabloid newspaper. But the broadsheets, the traditional broadsheet papers, are really not bought anymore because everyone's reading their news, getting their news online. And so the business model doesn't stand up. Now, we've got two quite good newspapers here in Britain, with The Independent and The Guardian. Now, The Independent, as I understand it, was actually losing less than The Guardian in terms of weekly amounts of money. But the bankers at The Independent have decided, oh, well, we are going to start pulling in the loans that we've extended to Lebedev, who owns The Independent newspaper. And we've just literally heard over the last couple of days that The Independent is no longer viable, and the journalists are going to be sacked, and there's going to be a continuing web presence for The Independent. But basically, most of the good journalism that's being produced by The Independent stable for the last 20 years or so is going. But The Guardian is carrying on, even though it seems to, on the surface of it, to be.
Well, now wait a minute. I want to add something here. It's my understanding The Independent in London is owned by a former Russian. Is that true?
Yes, that's right. He's the
son
of
an ex-secret
service guy from Russia. Yeah, Lebedev. Well, it could well be, couldn't it? And also, I would suggest most of the people I know are fairly switched on, particularly freelance journalists and people like that. It's the Independent stable has been our go-to place. They've been doing some really good challenging stories. For example, there was one last year about Operation Tiberius, which is a Scotland Yard inquiry, which was a report which came out in 2002, but it was secret for over 10 years. And that was revealed in the Independent, the basic details of that being that all of the major criminal justice institutions had been infiltrated and they were now being controlled by organised crime. That is to say, the HMRC, which is Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs, that is the tax system, the courts, that is to say, the judges and legal cartels of lawyers. Also, juries were being fixed regularly, and that the jury system was being controlled by organised crime. Also, the police and the National Crime Agency, which is this, our sort of equivalent of the FBI over here, all of it was being had been thoroughly infiltrated by organised crime, and so that, you know, it really gave complete impunity to organised crime in the country, which, you know, it's sort of equivalent, I suppose, in the city of London. To the analogy that, well, the criminals don't rob banks anymore, they own them. So the system has been totally compromised. Now, the only person that can really make a big difference to this is not politicians or people that vote for them. It's actually the monarchy, because the crown is extremely important in appointing judges, appointing things like prosecutors, this kind of thing. And so unless, bless her cotton socks, the Queen actually gets her fingers out and starts to correct this, in other words, to remove criminals in those positions and starts to, you know, put pressure on to get decent, honest people in those jobs, we have no functioning criminal justice system in Britain. So it does things like, you know, it will prosecute people for stealing a bottle of water from a shop or whatever, and they'll go to jail as an example. And yet the biggest criminal money laundering bank in the world, HSBC, you know, which, as you know, is nearly $1 trillion, they were shown to have been laundering for the Mexican drug cartels. But they get off scot-free. I mean, it's just a little fine, a tiny fine, actually, compared
well, now,
to...
Now, let's talk about that, because here in the United States, in Britain, you know a great deal about HSBC, of course, and what they're doing and the money laundering and the fines and everything. But here on our side of the pond, there's very little awareness of that. So why don't you give us the background? That's a really good entree into the bigger narco-trafficking angle. Tell us about HSBC.
There's a whole history here. I mean, around about the same time that the Bullingdon Club and the Skull and Bones were founded, there was also a similar kind of, I suppose, criminal cartels were being set up in the days when it was fairly easy to do things behind closed doors and there was no internet where people could share, even bloggers could share information about this sort of thing. The HSBC was set up by people who were involved in the illegal trade with the Far East, mostly opium. I mean, at the time, we even got to the stage where there were clipper ships like the Cutty Sark, which if you're ever in London, it's well worth a visit to that, although I'm not sure. I think it got a bit fire damaged recently, but it's a beautiful clipper ship, which these things are really the top-notch technology. They can go as fast and they're as reliable as many of the steam-powered ships that supposedly surpassed them. And the other thing is they didn't have to have vast amounts of coal in the holds, and they were zipping across the world. They were actually only made really extinct by the opening of the Suez Canal down the south of the Suez Canal, there are difficult wind currents that made it awkward for the clipper ships to negotiate them. But what was going on there? Well, you had this overt tea trade and this complete obsession with tea, you know, with the British drinking their tea all the time. But actually what the important cargo there was opium, and HSBC was intimately involved in the financing, secret financing, secret making money out of that trade. So that was the bank's origins. We then had a fine. The actual amount of the fine, I think, was it $2 billion? I'm not sure. Roughly $2 billion. But the fact of the matter was that HSBC had been actually turning over something like $1 trillion of cash from the drug money launderers. So this was a piffling, silly little fine, really. And, of course, it shouldn't have been a fine. The bank should have lost its banking license for that vast amount of money laundering. And all of the directors and senior management should have been arrested and sent down, you know, okay, after a fair trial.
Absolutely, they should have been arrested.
What's happening is we've got these criminal syndicates that are wandering around the world like Monsanto, posing as viable, legitimate corporations. And this is, I think, that where we're moving into this sort of fascist world now, the new version of fascism, where the actual effects of it are the same, you know, death and destruction, poverty, particularly when it's not right on our doorsteps here in Europe and in the United States, you know, when it's maybe on the periphery, say places like Greece that, you know, that don't count so much, or in Mexico, etc., a little bit out of the way, not right on your doorstep. But the effect is exactly the same as these the previous kinds of fascism. So what you've got effectively is banking being behind all this, you know, as I just described with The Guardian and in the Independent. It's the banks that decide which paper lives and which paper dies. It doesn't matter really which one's making a bit more money, but the banks decided The Guardian's a good paper and it's more viable financially. Therefore, the bank says we're not going to call their loan in. So they have an immense amount of power. And what's happening nowadays, and I think this has probably been best described by your very own journalist. Well, he's dead now. A guy called Paul Manning, who was a CBS correspondent in Europe during World War II. In fact, many people, anyone who could still alive from World War II, who would be listening to CBS, hearing reports from Europe about the progress of the war towards the end of the war, would remember his voice. And he wrote a book in the early 1980s explaining really what was going on with all the laundered money from the Nazis, much of which, of course, was used to give them safe passage, many to the United States, some to Britain, etc. And this was a really simple fact which seems to, you know, doesn't get a mention in the mainstream media, in the bloodstream. You know, this is why we have to do our white blood cell work.
It's that the banks are just like the tanks of old. And what they do is they finance, they take over, they do hostile takeover bids. The city institutions will also be involved in all sorts of other criminality.
When you say city, you mean the City of London.
City of London, yeah.
Yeah, City of London.
That's just the shorthand we use for it here, the city, yeah.
Yeah, okay, that's okay.
The banks really are the tanks of the modern era. And, I mean, there was a brilliant article, by the way, from Finian Cunningham, an Irish writer. I think it was on Global Research. And this was really, it was just a few months ago, and it was about the, I think it was called the Panzer Banks Destroy Greece. I'm pretty sure that was roughly the headline of it. And he goes,
Panzer Banks Destroy Greece.
German banks are being used in the same way to take over. The effect is the same, Susan. If you find yourself, you're running a company, a business, and you suddenly find yourself a victim of a hostile takeover, and somebody else then starts marching into your boardroom and says, right, this is all mine now, get out. At least the Nazis, when they did this kind of thing, they did it overtly, and they did it openly. They came into your town, they killed people, they blew things up, and they took over that way. What we're seeing is a much more subtle than that with these big corporations. And the reason I mentioned Paul Manning,
and they're German corporations, aren't they? In Europe, they are German.
Yes, many of them are. And of course, we've seen this big conference this weekend and Friday in Munich, of all places, to be. You know, with pronouncements from John Kerry from Skull and Bones about, you know, how dreadful the Russians are and how Assad is so awful, even though, you know, and he's trying to make out that it's not just another attempt at regime change. But look, this is key concept that Paul Manning explained in his book. The book's called Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. And it was Manning's sort of swan song, really, because of all the information he'd gained during World War II and after, following Nazis in South America, was that Bormann was helped by the British to escape at the end of the Second World War, and then stayed in Britain for a while, but then he was moved out to South America, where as a bureaucrat he set up 750 corporations from either Argentina or Paraguay, wherever he was at the time. He was just a boring old bureaucrat, but he set up these companies. And then the laundered money from World War II, which had been laundered through Switzerland and through Sullivan and Cromwell law firm in New York, that money was invested into those companies. And then literally thousands of ex-SS people just took off their uniforms, put on nice pinstripe suits. And of course, there's the SS sympathizers in other parts of the world. Of course, there were many in the US and many in Britain. They just marched into the boardroom and started a kind of post-war financial empire that was secretly financed through Nazi gold, through Sullivan and Cromwell, and through the Bormann network. So that, I think, was one of the most important. And I was put onto this book to read it. And I mean, it's, you know, there's a million different books out there you can read, but this one is one that was quite heavily suppressed initially when it first came out. It explains.
Say again what it is. Say the title again.
It's called Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. It's published, I think, 1982 by Paul Manning. And if you look at Paul Manning's credentials, they are amazing, Susan. I mean, this guy really was one of the top broadcast journalists. And, of course, broadcasting was quite a new thing in the Second World War. And, you know, one of the greatest, I think, US journalists of all time, especially to pursue doggedly what happened to the lost, so-called lost Nazi gold after the Second World War, because, of course, Switzerland wasn't really neutral. It was helping the Nazis quite a lot. A lot of the loot was quite happily stashed in under the mountains in Switzerland. And the Swiss did rather nicely out of it all as they sat on top of their mountains watching everyone fighting each other below them.
Wow. Yeah. But what you're describing here is always the fear of Europe, I'm stunned by this, because it was German imperialism in World War One that resulted in World War One, the desire for empire, and then German empire building in that started World War Two. And when one of the reasons that the Russians had insisted on the breaking up of Germany into East and West was that they were concerned that a unified Germany would overwhelm Europe and would swamp the independence and the sovereignty of these other European nations. And what you're saying to me is essentially that that's exactly what's happening.
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, I obviously there's lots and lots of, good, nice Germans out there. And I think they're pretty acute awareness, particularly
now what we're seeing with Angela Merkel. Angela Merkel and the Germans are governing a European continent, and they are refusing to the German, as you point out, these are German banks and British banks, the German banks and the City of London together. And the City of London seems to be holding out against Germany. But
well, it is to a certain extent. I think actually the city would like to keep Britain in the EU. But look, I mean, just go back to World War II again. Montague Norman was the governor of the Bank of England. He may as well have been a Nazi. He apparently didn't have a picture of Adolf Hitler on the wall of his office in the bank during the Second World War, but he may as well have done, for all of his actions seem to be around, who knows, maybe the Nazis are going to win this war, in which case we're going to have to be very friendly with them, so let's not upset them. And throughout the war, the same bank, the Bank for International Settlements in Switzerland, had been the central bank for central banks. So they're a representative from every central bank, and every major one on the planet would meet there every month in Switzerland. And this carried on through most of the war without a lot of questions actually being asked by the British. Now, the Americans, there's another story, at the BIS were being quite pushy about making sure the BIS and the Swiss maintain their neutrality. But the British weren't. I mean, we were saying, well, hang on, this is banking. This is nothing to do with the war. We've got to be cooperative with the Germans, etc. So, that it was the US that did the prosecutions for trading with the enemy of the Prescott Bush, etc. And there was much more of that kind of thing going on in the US than in Britain. And of course, the political outcome of all of this was in 1952. 1952 was one of the first pre-planning meetings, but 54, the first full-blown Bilderberg conference taking place in Oosterbeek in Holland. And this was really the political lobby for the sympathizers of the Nazis, and some of them had actually been in the SS, who were, I mean, Prince Bernhard, for example, who was chairing the Bilderberg conference for the first 20 years, ex-SS people, to bring these together as a political lobby in Europe, largely paid for and funded by the US, the first meetings. And that was, I think, one of the most powerful and influential forces on our modern world, was this Bilderberg meeting, and which is one of the things that kind of got me into a lot of this, I suppose you could call conspiracy journalism. I call it just investigative journalism, digging up, the facts about the real way that decisions are made, the real way power works. Because, I mean, I think it's really important, voting and all that, very important, but there are lots and lots of powerful institutions that have nobody vote for them, not least of which, of course, is the media. And in this country,
that's right. Or we're voting with our feet by leaving them. CNN and MSNBC on our side of the pond are losing rapidly.
Well, yeah, but the thing is, the bloggers don't have the resources to take over, do they? You can kind of keep on top of things. People like you and I, just about, but there isn't the big powerful institutions with enough kind of know-how and forced multiplication of lots of minds working on subjects to do proper investigative journalism. It just isn't happening, which is why people like Ed Vulliamy at The Guardian and the work that he's done with Roberto Saviano is so important. I mean, we started by talking about that, didn't we, Susan? If you, if you don't mind, I'd just like to go back to that article. This came out.
We're actually about to go to a break right now. Everybody, we're talking with Tony Gosling, who is an incredible investigative journalist on the in the alternative media in Britain, and you just have such a wealth of knowledge, and you have a. It's so fascinating to hear the British perspective on world events as opposed to the Americans, okay, right back, everybody.
That my teeth, bro.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Covert Report with Susan Lindauer. Today, we're speaking with Tony Gosling, investigative journalist from Britain, and we're talking about the City of London and the corruption of the Bilderberg power base and its origins with the banks, and it's quite fascinating. So thank you so much, Tony, for being with me today. Let's talk about the drug cartels, the narco trafficking.
Yeah, this is Ed Valiemi's. He did this article for The Guardian on Boxing Day, at Christmas, 26th of December. The article's called "The Man Who Exposed the Lie of the War on Drugs," and it's really a kind of look at Roberto Saviano, this poor guy who's living in hiding under 24/7 guard after death threats. After his book about the Neapolitan mafia, is basically one of the, I think, most important whistleblowers on the planet, and he's been living in undisclosed venues now for 8 years, with a permanent dispatch of seven of the Italian Carabinieri armed guards. You know, this is a pretty horrific existence he's had. But in the meantime, he's been writing books that have been really annoying quite a lot of the most powerful
people. That's brilliant, though. That's brilliant, because if they're keeping you under lock and key in seclusion, there you have to find a way to break out of that isolation.
We've got to ask, what on earth is the point of having something like Sky News or the BBC, CBS or Fox if they haven't had this guy sitting on there regularly commentating on the global financial situation, the viability of our financial system, etc. I mean, of course, most of the what we're seeing to do with financial journalism, apart from a few notable exceptions, I mean, there is particularly a guy over here in Britain called Ian Fraser, who I thoroughly recommend, who's written the book on the really exposing the Royal Bank of Scotland and the massive frauds that have been going on by them. But most of the financial journalists are very, very close to the financial system they're supposed to be reporting on. And so we don't get any of the reality. And what they end up doing, and this is a slow process that's happened, I suppose, over 30, 40 years, is that you're just getting PR, basically. Yes, the financial system is wonderful. It's robust. And they're just there to sell the confidence in the system. And anybody that starts criticizing it, pointing out that it's a collapse at any time, it's full of crime, that crime may be prosecuted. For example, we just had, haven't we, there's another fine on I think it was on it's HSBC, another court case announced last week by families of people who died in Mexico. I think it's US relatives of people who, Americans that have died. So this is another potential massive compensation claim.
Wow. So the families of those who died in Mexico under the drug cartels are suing the bank?
That's right. Yeah. But see, the thing is, this is bad news. You see, as I used to be told when I was at the BBC, the wrong story. That's the wrong story, Tony. But of course, the wrong story for the editor and the manager and the owner, the person who owns the transmitters, the licenses, the printing presses, is often the right story for the public that will want to read about it if they really want to know what's going on in the world. So you've got a massive extra exposure of the bank, HSBC, because of all the potential compensation claims there. This is something which they, you know, it's just going to sink the share price, could tip it over the edge, could cause a kind of house of cards collapse. We've heard this week also that Deutsche Bank has been on the brink of collapse, has only by some weird miracle been able to survive the week, because they're so massively exposed to the derivatives markets that could turn, you know, literally at a puff of wind could turn these derivative markets round. And so there's another aspect to this that people don't necessarily understand, and that is the way that journalism actually works through the wire services like Reuters, Associated Press, Press Association here in Britain. Most of these wire services, which is where most of the original news articles come from, and they just get cut and pasted into our newspapers, they are getting most of their money from financial services, that is to say reporting day-to-day figures for various stocks and shares, commodity prices. That's their bread and butter. News, the stuff we read in our newspapers, is really just a kind of sideline to their main business. So, of course, they are very, very close to these big financial institutions, and they don't want to upset them. They don't want to write things that are liable to collapse the stock exchange or, you know, give bad news. And so that is a massive side to this that people hardly ever see. But I think I should get back really to the.
Well, now wait a minute. You just said something about Deutsche Bank being on the verge of collapse. None of that is showing up in the American press at all.
Well, no,
on our side of the pond, all of this information is being suppressed.
Well,
all of the information about HSBC is suppressed. All of the information about Deutsche Bank and the fact that these big banks, you know, here we hear that they're too big to fail. And, you know, and there's a fear of destabilizing them. And, you know, there's all kinds of problems associated with that, but we're not hearing that they're like teetering on the brink of the abyss.
Well, that's right, because this is the wrong story, and also it could help them go over the abyss, which, I mean, to some extent is a legitimate concern. You want to be 100% sure before you release a story that collapses the entire world financial house of cards. So anyway, going back to Roberto Saviano, this just amazing guy that's got hardly any publicity at all and probably should be on our TVs every other night, you know, talking about what's really going on in the world. I mean, he's basically saying that cocaine capitalism is central to our economic universe. And he talks about Escobar, you know, the drug dealer in Mexico, as the Copernicus of organized crime. No business in the world is so dynamic, so restlessly innovative, so loyal, he says, to the pure free market spirit as the global cocaine business. And he's saying essentially in this book that actually what's happened is it's been such a survivor, this criminal coke market, that the legitimate, so-called legitimate business world is copying their success model. And of course, what we're in a situation now of is you've got with the bailouts and the rollback of the state, there's less and less proper investigations by prosecutors. So what's happening is the most criminal banksters, if you want, most criminal banks are the ones that are doing the best. And this is a kind of race to the bottom in terms of morality. He says capitalism needs the criminal syndicates and the criminal markets now, because without it, they would collapse. And in fact, he's absolutely right. If you look at what happened in 2008, HSBC and other banks took in vast amounts of cash from the drug cartels in order to survive so they could continue paying cash out in other parts of the country, in other parts of the world, you know, in order to for you and
wow.
I down the banks to actually get our cash. A lot of that probably had traces of cocaine on it still. And that the black market, he says, has become the biggest market in the world now. This is what's not being reported. This is, I think, the bigger picture on the slow collapse.
Ed Vuillamy, I'm probably is I don't know if it was Roberto Saviani or Ed Vuillamy, I'm probably mispronouncing his name, said Pablo Escobar was the first to understand that it's not the world of cocaine that that must orbit around the markets, but the markets that must rotate around cocaine.
Yeah, he says also that narco cartels like Guzman's are not adversaries of global capitalism, not even pastiches of it. They're integral to it and pioneers of free market capitalism now. They are its role model. What a brilliant, interesting way of looking at things. The role model for capitalism is now, you know,
narco-trafficking.
I'm a big fan of Humphrey Bogart, and I'm sure many of your listeners will have seen that wonderful film of his, Key Largo, which is to do with the Prohibition days in the US. I think they're down in Florida in the film.
Yes.
And it really does, I mean, if you haven't seen that for a while, go and get a copy of it on Netflix, or shouldn't really advertise, or wherever, or a DVD, and watch it. It's so absolutely brilliant to see how much the gangsters hate the idea that drugs, for example cocaine, might go into the legal framework, be legalized, be decriminalized. That is the thing they're most scared of, because the fact that it is outside the law that enables them to make so much money, to just basically kill people if they're get in the way, and it creates this massive economy which the rest of the world is now starting to use as its role model outside the real economy, untaxed. And he talks about his book 000. I was quite curious as to where does he get this from, this name, and it's a wry reference impact to the name of the best grade of flour ideal for making pasta in Italy, yeah. This 000 is also being used by
the purest flour for pasta,
yeah. And they've used this as a sort of mafia's term for the very best cocaine. So that's why he's used that as his title for his book. But if you think about that, that's interesting, isn't it, that he's comparing it to flour and that the mafia have been doing that, because we're now in a situation where we've got this massive company called Cargill's, which is controlling most of the world's flour, funnily enough. And who sits on the board of that? And who is it that is looking at the possibility of now speculating, using things like these collateralized debt obligations and derivatives, on the possible complete collapse of the world flour market due to a war or whatever? People are now betting on the flour market, flour prices going through the roof, and they will make an absolute fortune if there's a war. So you've got a really good comparison there, I think, between cocaine and flour. Cocaine in the illegal world, flour in the legal world. But actually, the way that ruthless, greedy, I don't want to swear, but I mean, these kinds of people are in both the legitimate and the illegitimate, in the legal and the illegal markets, doing exactly the same thing, modeled on the successes, so-called financial successes of the criminals.
Yeah, but the quest for power is going to drive them more and more to the criminal side, because the criminals will protect each other, especially when they're in the banks, especially when they've infiltrated the drug cartels, as this becomes more and more incestuous. And the racketeering component of this, when they have to sequester resources, and they make a decision, there it will come to a point where we have useless eaters, and I think it won't. I think it'll happen sooner than people think, like in the next 20, maybe not 10 years from now, but 20 years, 25 years, there will be a point where a decision will be made that some people are entitled to food and protection and the benefits of the law, and others will not be entitled, and huge swaths of society will just be targeted for elimination.
What's happened is we've had a massive increase in technology, which should have freed up millions of us with vast amounts of leisure time. Instead, those who own that technology have kept it very much to themselves and used it as a way of aggrandizing more and more wealth. I mean, you know, we've got now something like 2/3 of the population effectively in Britain here is almost surplus to requirements. You know,
there you go. It's not that we hold on. It's not. I disagree with you on one key point. I want to stop you right there. What they see as leisure time and superfluous time that we can enjoy ourselves is actually unemployment time. They don't need the workers anymore. They don't, the production is not labor intensive. So therefore you have a whole bunch of people who can go home and sit in their houses without jobs and call that leisure time.
Well, it's also the fact here in Britain is we've got something like half of the low pay, or actually, I mean, if you're looking at the lowest half of the people's pay, that slice of the population is actually having to claim benefits of various sorts. So, you know, we ended up with a situation that work is no longer a way out of dependency on state benefits and welfare payments. But look, just to get back to, before we finish with 000, this amazing book, which I think is probably, Ed Valiemi is probably right in saying this is the book of the decade, is he talks about it as very Darwinian. He says, in a mafioso, if a mafioso messes up, he dies. And thus, they develop a system of survival. When they make a mistake, they're killed and replaced by someone even more ruthless, so that the organization becomes more ruthless and stronger all the time. So this is the sort of model which we're now seeing our corporations following, absolute ruthlessness. And that, I'm afraid, it's a bit like science, really. If you take morality out of business, it really just becomes a monster devouring people and anything in its path. And that's, I think, where we are. In big business now, there's just no morality. And the same in science. I mean, we're now talking about the very first Britain being the pioneer of designer babies. We're talking about getting human embryos, using them for experimentation like lab rats, you know. So we've gone completely out of the moral sphere, moral compass, when it comes to science and big business.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. But here in the it's interesting because here in the United States, what do you think of Donald Trump? What do you think of the whole politics of discontent, the Bernie Sanders Donald Trump paradigm? Have you followed that at all? I mean, you have Corbyn. You have Corbyn, don't you?
Yes, of course. Corbyn is actually, I think, he's a fantastic influence here in Britain, even though he's not amazingly slick as a sort of PR operation as a politician. People actually starting to really warm to him because he's asking the same sort of questions week after week as millions of British people are that are not getting asked anywhere else. Not particularly by our press, things like cost of housing, availability of people having somewhere to live, having to pay something like 100 times over the odds for some, just to get a roof over your head for the night. This is the stuff that Jeremy Corbyn's been focusing on. I mean, he's a sort of dyed-in-the-wool, old-fashioned socialist Labour. And we had a really fantastic – I mean, I know in America it's a bit of a bad word for a lot of people, but we had a fantastic experience with socialism post-war here in Britain with a socialist government brought in 1945, which nationalised a lot of big industries. And everything was run – the railways, the water, the electricity and everything – was run at cost because they realised, well, hang on a minute, look – We need to recover as a country. We don't want people making money out of the basic needs of society. The basic fundamental needs of society need to be provided at cost. And the government not only made sure that was possible, but they made sure that the whole process was transparent. So anyone who had questions about the awarding of contracts, all that sort of thing, questions for the people who were the civil servants running those public industries, it was all done totally openly. You could see where every pound, every penny went. And that was a really healthy, and it enabled Britain to sort of pick itself up by its bootstraps at the end of the Second World War and start rebuilding straight away and build massive amounts of council housing, public housing, make sure that by the time we got to the 1960s and 1970s, everybody in Britain was housed in a decent, really decent house, somewhere to live at a reasonable cost. And it was actually a brilliant experience for us, socialism in Britain. And I think, you know, there are all sorts of questions about, you know, how it's done. But the basic principle has got to be there. If you're going to have decent civilized society, you've got to make sure that everybody has the very basics to live. You know, food, water, shelter, Maslow's hierarchy of needs kind of stuff. And then you can start to look at, you know, more exploration, entrepreneurism, doing innovation of various sorts, making money out of luxuries, taxing luxuries. But we should have a real good basic, and that's what the British did very successfully, I think. And it's what Margaret Thatcher started to take down, basically.
I remember, now this is, gosh, you guys, I hate to tell you how long ago this was. When Maggie Thatcher was prime minister, I was in London at the London School of Economics. And that should tell you how long ago this was. But I remember on the Thames, there would be these huge billboards by the Labour Party announcing how many millions or how many tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of British workers were unemployed. And they broadcast the unemployment statistics every single day.
Yes. Let me tell you a bit about that, because that was we had. If you go to Westminster Bridge, you'll find on the North Bank, there's the Houses of Parliament. On the South Bank, there was what they call City Hall, which was, or County Hall, which was the base for the Greater London Council, which was Labour. So you had a Labour-run Greater London Council, which was the local government administration for the whole of London, on the one side, which was run by a socialist left-wing Ken Livingstone, Labour Party man. And on the other side of the Thames, you had Margaret Thatcher and the Tories. So
yeah, it was beautiful.
Yeah,
I mean, it was Labour speaking back right in the face of power. It was like, Livingstone.
Giant billboards pointing out to the House of Commons day after day, you know, how many people were unemployed. But of course, what happened was Margaret Thatcher was so annoyed with that, and her cohorts, people like Oliver Letwin, who's still in politics here in Tory policy, and Victor Rothschild, who was very influential, even though he was a Labour peer in the privatisation programme of Thatcher, that what they did is they just abolished the Greater London Council. So Ken Livingstone had to disappear off with his tail between his legs. But actually, for a lot of Londoners,
they just got rid of it. That happened after I left.
Yes, yeah. I think it was the mid-1980s. They'd had enough. Margaret Thatcher had enough of Ken Livingstone taking the mickey out of her from the other side of the Thames, so he abolished him. Abolished the whole institution.
It was brilliant. It was a brilliant rejoinder, you know, rebuke. A brilliant rebuke to Tory politics was, look what, how many tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people are unemployed on the dole right now. Which means they're not contributing, they're not participating, they can't take care of their families. And it is more expensive to have unemployed peoples who are then dependent on the state.
But the Conservatives have never really been interested in saving money. They want to use money for political ends for example, which was set up by Winston Churchill himself, a Tory, after the Second World War, something called Remploy here in Britain, which was a whole network right across the country of all the major towns had their Remploy depot, which was a manufacturing and office work base for anyone who was disabled in any way. They would find the sorts of work that disabled people can do to give them a bit of pay and a bit of dignity.
Absolutely, that's a better life. That is a better life.
So what did David Cameron do when he first got into office? He abolished it. Now, this is not only is this a kick in the teeth for the disabled, which is just characteristic of the kind of fascistic policies that we've been having here in Britain, really ever since the 2010 election with Cameron taking over from Gordon Brown. But, you know, kicking disabled people in the teeth, insulting their intelligence and throwing them onto state benefits. And then, of course, saying that they've got to prove for every single penny, they've got to crawl and beg for every single penny they get. But it doesn't even make sense for the country as a whole, because the Remploy was actually doing fantastic. You know, it was actually paying for itself and paying for these disabled people's wages. Instead, they'd rather smash that to pieces, which is what they did right across the country, and pay these people welfare benefits. So they're really vandals, appalling behaviour.
I have a comment from the chat room that is coming back to the United States now, and I want to pull, but it's a really interesting comment. And it is that the repercussions are going to start in April 15th, 2016. And that they're saying that there expects to be a 30% devaluation in the U.S. dollar, and that that'll happen in April, and then 6 months later, in October 1st, 2016, there will be another 30% devaluation in the U.S. dollar. Now, again, I know you're talking about the British politics. I would like to hear what you have to say as a British person about the Trump Sanders Clinton race, because here is something that is what my chat room is, the point they're making is during a presidential season, the game is to keep economic problems out of the picture and to hold them off until after November. But this is 2016 is just here in the United States, we got earthquakes going off. We've got tornadoes coming off. Hurricane, it's like hurricane force. The economy is just like, it's just not cooperating. The seismic shifts cannot be pushed back and delayed. There can be no, and so what is your take on all of this?
Well, there always
another comment is saying we are going back to real assets, which will enhance the values in the currencies. But what if we don't have assets? So talk about that if you can.
Well, look, I mean, we've been living on funny money, really, haven't we? Ever since the Nixon taking off the gold standard. I mean, look, and probably from, if you go back to the times of Henry VIII here, he was, you know, he did the dissolution of the monasteries, which was thieving fantastic amounts of land. And what's one of the, if you ever come to Britain as a tourist, you can go and see some of the massive ruined abbeys around the country, which were destroyed by Henry VIII. But the other thing he did was he was the first person to really debase British currency. So all the silver coin that was passing around in Britain, Henry VIII wanted to use it for his various wars. So he took it all in and he started reissuing all the coins.
Everybody, we'll be right back. This is Covert Report with Cody Gossett. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Covert Report. Today, we're talking with Tony Gosling, a British investigative journalist. And right before the break, I was asking you, Tony, if you can talk about this. I realize I'm asking you to comment on something on the other side of the pond. It's something that's happening here in the United States. But I'm very interested in your global perspective of the decline of the U.S. dollar. And one of the people in our chat room wisely, correctly pointed out that on April 15th of this year, 2016, there will be a currency reevaluation, and currencies stay stable and then they change. They fluctuate on a tiny margin, but about every 6 months, there's a major assessment as to what will happen. And we are expecting that there will be a 30% devaluation in the US dollar on April 15th, and that in October, there will be another 30% devaluation in the USS dollar. And what we're seeing is the replacement of the US petrodollar as the global currency. And it's all happening. 2016 is such a dynamic year. It's a scary year. It is a year of retribution. A global retribution for all the mistakes and the crimes of the U.S. government, and the funny money, forcing other people to buy our bonds, other governments to buy our bonds. All of this is coming to a screeching, calamitous, and if you're an American, calamitous end. The over-consumption. assumption.
Just a minute.
I don't think
it's just if you're American. I mean, nowadays, we're living in a very much a globalized world where the dollar is probably the most important currency still. But, everything is dependent on everything else nowadays because of the free markets. One of the first things Margaret Thatcher, you mentioned earlier, did in 1980 was open up the exchange controls and capital markets. So, really, there is very little difference between the European nations and the US, the dollar and the pound. There is certainly it does give any country a bit more power over its industry to control its own currency. And it really is the main kind of, sovereignty nowadays is having your own currency. But, if anything happens in Europe, as we've just been seeing recently with China, Friday, the Japanese stock market lost 5%, and everyone was thanking God that there was a national holiday in China and the Chinese markets were closed. So it's a global system that they've created. And when it all goes down, I think it'll go down, all as one. But look, you wanted me to comment on...
It'll go down all as one.
Yeah, I think so. Basically the confidence will go because the confidence is the only thing that's keeping the markets going at the moment. All of the QE money, which is all funny money, just made up out of nowhere, like heroin kind of injected into the system, and the system has become now completely addicted to this QE, printed money. It's failing to do its job anymore. Even in Germany, that where they first of all they said, "Oh, we're not going to take any QE money." Well, of course, they finally eventually did take it. And the fact of the matter is, we have not come out of recession since 2008. We've been in a constant recession. It's just that this QE money has created an illusion of growth because it's been propping up stock prices, stocks and shares, and it's been propping up asset prices. That's mostly to do with property prices, and commodities as well to a certain extent, but mainly property prices here in Britain are astronomical. And of course, this has a false, for anyone that doesn't really get economics, I've only taken it's taken me a while to get my head around this, but what happens is if you can use that QE money to artificially pump up the price to a kind of bubble status of property and stocks and shares, then the amounts of those transactions is going up, right? So because the market's going up, the actual quantities of money apparently moving around looks like you've got growth, but you don't have growth. What you've got actually is an economy that's going down. The real economy is going down all the time. It's only this kind of artificial world pumped up by quantitative easing that makes it look like there's something going up. It isn't. Anyone, pretty much who's living in the real world will tell you that ordinary people, consumers, just have less and less money all the time to spend. And that's the real economy. And that's why what we're doing is just finding another sort of sticking plaster to stick over the puncture wound made by the heroin needle from day to day, from week to week, to make it look like there is some kind of recovery. And of course, most of the financial journalists desperately want to talk the whole situation up so that there is a recovery. Oh yes, it's okay, we're going to be in for another 5 minutes. What they're doing, of course, is just making a situation where another crash. Well, we didn't have a crash in 2008. We had a massive bailout. If there is another crash on the horizon, which I think there is, probably sooner than the 10 years you were talking about earlier, Susan, it's just there's not going to be any money to bail out the banks. They're just going to go down. And actually what's going to happen then is that the big investment banks, like people like the Rothschilds, etc., are going to make a fantastic amount of money buying up vast amounts of assets for peanuts. And I noticed, by the way, talking about the Rothschilds, that Linda Rothschild just today tweeted something about Hillary Clinton. What did she say? Send this to every American you know and retweet it. We need to do this together with Hillary, and big sort of kiss marks from Linda Rothschild endorsing Hillary Clinton.
Well, wow, Linda Rothschild's endorsed Hillary Clinton?
Yeah, well, there's a surprise, eh? Because these people are all in it together and they're making a fantastic amount of money.
But they're not endorsing Ted Cruz. They're not endorsing Marco Rubio. They're not endorsing Jeb Bush.
Apparently, not. Well, I don't know. All I'm doing is saying.
No. This is very important.
She's a Democrat. Yeah.
You're right.
Bernie is the man. Bernie is the man. Quite obviously, for anybody with a half a brain can see, he's the sort of guy you can have an honest conversation with. He's not just in politics for the nice fat cat job he's going to get afterwards. He's in it for the long term. And Hillary, I mean, not only is she the New World Order's kind of little paid servant, it's quite obvious. She does everything that they want. She's also criminally liable for the Benghazi incident and many other things that have come out with these emails. But, you know, why would anybody even think about voting for Hillary? She's just got the gift of the gab. She's got massive amounts of money behind her. And I noticed also at your primaries last week, she cheated, didn't she? They had some sort of competition where you get, I'm not exactly sure about how the US system works, but there are apparently some kind of like superdelegates, and all of the superdelegates that were nominated directly by the Democratic Party hierarchy all voted for Hillary. So even though she didn't actually win the vote, because she got more of these extra super votes from these superdelegates, it looked like she had. You know, so they're even...
That's how they pushed her over the top in Iowa. Right. That's how they pushed her over the top in Iowa, yes.
Amazing, really.
Because it was a 50-50 split. Bernie Sanders did an amazing job. Now, he is – but it's interesting that the Rothschilds – I would bet money that the Rothschilds would rather have a Republican in office.
Well, look, hang on, Susan, just a minute.
But Hillary Clinton is the one that they're choosing on the Democrat side.
Well, look, hang on a minute.
Very interesting.
Yeah, that's right. What they do is they'll have some Rothschilds who are steering – the Republican voters and other Rothschilds who are steering the Democrat voters. So Linda Rothschild's obviously one of the steerers. She's trying to sort of get everybody behind Hillary, as you might expect for someone who is going to make lots of money out of any wars that Hillary's been behind in the past and going to be behind in the future. So, you know, that's, I think, the way it works. But look, Trump is an interesting one, isn't he? And I noticed Alex Jones and InfoWars being very much sort of pro-Trump. I don't have any particular preference over on the Republican side. I think it's all pretty dark over there. But I think Trump is, you know, he may win quite worryingly. The reason that I don't trust him at all is because of his extreme Islamophobia. This extreme Islamophobia is the signature of the Gladio people, right? The Gladio 2 people. That is to say, the people who are wanting to demonize Islam just the same way the Jews were demonized by the Nazis. And the reason that's happening is because we are about to see, I think, and we're already seeing, obviously, in Paris before Christmas, a wave of terrorist attacks that will all be blamed on Muslims. One piece of news that came out last week was that the guy that the French Secret Service had blamed that attack on, the guy who's supposed to be on the run, well, they've got his suicide vest and it doesn't have any of his DNA on it. So it wasn't his suicide vest. So they're lying to us about who did the Paris attacks. What's going to happen, I think, is we're going to start to see in the future, not quite sure when, but it's starting to happen already, is terror attacks happening right across the Western world, in Europe and the United States, which are blamed on Muslims but are being carried out by mercenaries who are being in the employ of the big corporations, the big companies, and also law enforcement, which should kick in when these things happen, has been compromised. So the FBI, CIA, and the not so much your local police, I don't think they're involved, but at the highest levels, that there will be no prosecution of the real culprits of these crimes. Now, that's exactly the sort of thing we've been seeing for years now in places like Baghdad and in Libya. Since the overthrow of Gaddafi, is bomb attacks with impunity. And I think that is what bothers me about Trump, is that he's going down this road of blaming Islam and blaming the Arabs for this attack, which is actually a Gladio attack by NATO, by our very own people against us personally. And we've got, as you know, we've got plenty of evidence that right through the 1960s, right through the 1970s and 80s, these bomb attacks in Europe, particularly in Italy, in Germany. It now looks as if in Northern Ireland too, Susan, some stuff's come out in the last week or so pointing to that. Many Northern Ireland attacks, supposedly done by the IRA here in Britain, like the Birmingham pub bombings, etc., also being Gladio attacks. So this, I think, is the New World Order, if you want, the modern Fourth Reich, whatever you want to call them, way of doing things is to be using those bomb attacks to destroy any kind of legitimate political opposition here in the West. And we've got to really be aware that people like Trump, who are starting to trying to point the finger at Islamist terrorists as being behind this, are just as bad as the Nazis blaming the Jews back in the 1930s and 1940s.
Yeah, there you go. That's, well, you know what? The tragedy of all the Islamic attacks are that the number one victim are other Muslims. And we are forgetting this. We're pretending that we're thinking of ourselves and the impact on the West. But the greatest suffering, the greatest misery caused by ISIS is being felt by the Arab community. Women, I grieve for Arab women who have worked so hard to come into to get it, the rights of education, the rights in marriage, the rights to divorce. I mean, it's crazy how Islam is so deeply offended by women's empowerment at the most primitive basis, the most primitive level. And those women have fought. And they fight in a different way than we do. Like, American women would never tolerate that crap. Don't even think about it. Tony, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you fine. Can you
okay,
hear me?
Tony, I'm going to let you do the talking because something has just happened and I am no longer able to hear you at all.
Okay.
I don't know what's going on.
I can hear you fine.
Tony, I will ask you the question. What do you think of BRICS and the Chinese?
Well, okay, here's a little story. I met up with some people who were quite close to British foreign intelligence probably 20 years ago, and they were a little bit drunk at the time. They were saying, well, what are we going to do about the Chinese? Everybody else, we got their measure of them, etc., but not the Chinese. The Chinese are very much an unknown quantity, I think, even still. And what's happened with the way that the British and Americans have driven European foreign policy in Ukraine and Syria now has convinced the Chinese that they want nothing to do with us. They're going in with the Russians. And of course, they are sitting around creating alternative financial models to the Bretton Woods criminal cartel, the IMF, which had used money to enslave Africans and South Americans, third world countries, up until the turn of the century, and are now using those very self-same tactics they used, structural adjustment and privatization, to destroy Europe, Greece probably the most, and Britain bit by bit. They're using a kind of form of financial warfare. Effectively, you know, that's what we're dealing with, financial warriors. So, I mean, we've got to, I suppose, fight back in a way just by simply getting our heads around what's going on. This is, I think, you know, when we were talking about the media earlier, where it's so important to actually just get some decent info and to go around the
okay.
Call out Bill Gates here, because Bill Gates owns Skype, and maybe it's one of his friends that tripped out our line there, Susan.
Yeah, I tell you, it was just kind of funny. I was talking to you, and we were having a great conversation, and then all of a sudden, the sound just dropped out, and I couldn't hear anything you were saying there.
Well, the line was dropped, but anyway, you know what I was talking about briefly was that, you know, how impressed I was with the Iranians. Really robust, very friendly. I met some of the people from their Republican Guard who were looking after us over there. Actually, really personable. I mean, I've met MI5 over here. They're kind of spooky characters. They're quite dark. They don't talk to you. They're kind of preoccupied with some kind of bad agenda. I don't know quite what, but these were ordinary, real people. And I was really impressed by the way that, you know, there's an obvious preeminence of women there in their intellectual understanding of how to deal with the rest of the world and terrorism. Is certainly no oppression of women in the university, in the academic institutions and the conference centers where I was at all, because they were virtually leading the affair. So this is a complete myth about Islam generally. It may be true in Saudi Arabia, our supposed ally, but it's not true in Iran at all. And it's important to understand how many people in Iran have died. 15,000, really, since the revolution in 1979, as a direct result of mostly US CIA covert operations blowing ordinary people up. Now, of course, there's been also a US-Israeli campaign, probably the British involved as well, to kill nuclear physicists and scientists in Iran. That's also important for us to understand how that deeply that affects the... I mean, if you imagine if the Iranians just kill one of our nuclear scientists, people would go nuts. And they've done an amazing job, I think, in taking this on the chin and saying, OK, we're not going to have any retribution against you guys. We're just going to try and negotiate with you. And I think they've done an amazing job. So I'm really quite a fan of the Iranian independence. I like the idea of countries around the world being independent and not having to be part of a massive power block, coming back to BRICS, as there's brinkmanship by the US and Britain in Ukraine, the same in Syria through this Munich conference this weekend. You've got it's very becoming very, very difficult for countries to maintain their independence. They're going to have to go with one of these bigger power blocks, which is a great, great pity. And then eventually at the end of all that, well, we're going to get economic collapse and a war. And I think the question is really which one comes first, probably collapse or maybe war first, and then the collapse will be blamed on the other side. So we can point the finger as the financial system goes down the drain over at Putin, at the Chinese, and say it's all your fault. Where actually, you know, it's our complete mismanagement of the global economy, and the IMF's mismanagement, which has caused it in the first place, and the Bilderbergers' mismanagement. You know, they're the people actually at the heart of the politics, the lobbying that goes on between politics and the financial system is Bilderberg. And we can point the finger, I think, if this all does go down the tube, directly at them.
Well, I'll tell you something. BRICS is scaring, deeply scary to Washington, because it is made up, of course, of Brazil, Russia, Iran, China, and South Africa, who used to be an ally. Germany is trying to get into BRICS. Malaysia and some of these other major economies are making alliances with BRICS. If I were BRICS, I'd keep Germany out because they're such, pardon me, assholes. I would say that anything that strengthens German hegemony would be a mistake, countering the United, you know, it would be creating a new United States, which I certainly would not like to see. But I think that there's some interesting things that are happening. Donald Trump, of course, came out last night, and Tony, you wouldn't know this, but Donald Trump came out and vigorously attacked the Iran peace deal. And I support the Iran peace deal. I think it was a brilliant piece of diplomacy. I am very delighted and pleased any time that diplomacy is pursued rather than a war footing. I think it's so important to bring Iran back. It's a positive action to bring Iran back into the fold, give them a stake in the global economy and a place to play and participate. And it opens up a whole new market, and the dynamic of exchange and cultural interaction will be very powerful. I do fear for I do realize that the Iran has some oppression, which I would be a little bit afraid to go over there because of my past background.
No, don't, please don't. You know, yes, you have to wear a veil, but other than that, you will notice very little difference if you go and go swimming, etc. I did an interview with Soraya Sepahpour Ulrich, who lives in the US. I mean, maybe you'd like to have her on your show to talk about this, but she was born in Iran. Her family are all over there. She was brought up in London, in South West London, went to school there, and now she lives in California. And she was just, you know, really quite disappointed in women that say, oh, I don't want to go to Iran, because she's saying, look, wear a veil. It's not actually, most of the Iranian women, I noticed this is becoming kind of less fashionable all the time. They kind of push the veil back to the back of their heads.
You know, a veil, it does not intimidate me. A veil does not intimidate me as long as women can participate and contribute. Saudi Arabia scares me to death, where they don't want women to hold jobs. Women are locked into rooms. I mean, women, when a man goes to work and or when a man leaves the house, in Saudi Arabia, women are locked up into the house so that they cannot leave the house without a male escort. And the same is true in Pakistan.
But can I just interrupt you a second?
Sure.
Because there are some people like Soraya who point out, well, look, Rouhani is the president of Iran now. Has only managed really to get these negotiations going because he's allowing big British and American oil companies in to Iran. So there may be some kind of, you know, deals been done behind the scenes to say, well, you know, we will be friends with you. We'll treat you as a member of the international community, but only if you let our oil companies come in and start messing around in Iran. So that is a bit of a potential downside of the, I mean, although the deal itself is brilliant, it's wonderful, we just got the British embassy open in for the first time for many.
I think it's brilliant, absolutely fantastic. We'll be right back after the break. This is the COVID Report with Tony Gosling, investigative journalist in Britain. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the COVID Report with Susan Lindauer. My great guest today, Tony Gosling. We're talking about the economy, the global economy, the banks, the Bilderbergers, and Iran. Iran is the new kid on the block, the old kid on the block, who has come back in a new form, and I think it's great. I want to be really clear on this point. I think it's a tremendous improvement and advancement. I'm also delighted about Cuba, tiny little Cuba. I'm so pleased that the United States finally has normalized our relations with Cuba. This is all very, very, very positive. So even when the world is moving in fits and starts, racing off on the fast track towards the abyss and oblivion, at the same time, we're seeing some very important positive things, positive dynamics. I completely disagree with Donald Trump that he should tear up. And this is what he said, Tony, last night, that Donald Trump last night said that if he was elected, and he is right now the front runner in the Republican Party, Tony, so this is actually of concern, that his first action would be to tear up that Iranian contract and the Iranian agreement. Now, fortunately, everybody, we got to be really clear for all you Republicans out there, even if Donald Trump said that he doesn't want to play in that game anymore, the international community, the United Nations, has already suspended the sanctions. There is no way that Donald Trump could unilaterally force the United Nations to reinstate those sanctions. They're already gone, and no one is going to follow us. So the only thing that Donald Trump is doing or would achieve is to alienate the rest of the world and show, you know, once again, that the United States is on a completely different footing, and now we become irrelevant because the rest of the world takes a look at us and says, yeah, you, America, with your $18, $19 trillion in debt, are going to tell us what to do? I don't think so. Your petrodollar is in the trash. We've just devalued it 30% again. And we're not using your currency as the world standard for trade. So what exactly do you think you're going to do? You're going to huff and puff and throw a fit and throw a tantrum? I would say to all the people who are supporting Donald Trump, you need to tell your candidate to shut up. Because all you're doing, you're not going to win on the global stage. That fight is already over. Really, that fight is already over and the good guys won. Finally, something intelligent happened in the global community. And all you're doing is showing that the United States lacks the power and the clout to reassert itself on this point. And no one will follow us. And then you would deliver a victory to, quote, the enemy. If you see Iran as the enemy, and I don't. I do not see Iran as an enemy. But what you would be doing is showing that the United States, when the United States puffs up and huffs and puffs and it tries to blow the house down, we got COPD. Okay? We got chronic bronchitis. We can't do this anymore. We don't have the power and the might to overturn this house. So this is one fight we should not even try to take on. And besides that, it's a stupid fight. This was a good victory. This is one of the good things that Obama has done. And the fact that you don't like Obama does not mean that occasionally he doesn't do something right. And this is one of those times. Okay, Tony, take it from there.
Well, no, I agree with you. But I think, I mean, our politics in the West now, I mean, Corbyn is an exception and Bernie Sanders is an exception. But most of these candidates are backed by big money. You know, you're talking, you know, 6-7 figure sums. And the money is stolen money. It's a lot of it's drug money. But it's backing many of our candidates. And of course, the other thing that they use this money for is lawyers to try and shut people up from pointing that out, particularly if they happen to have audiences of 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 million over in the States, much more, of course, on TV every night to point these facts out. I mean, we're going through. It's criminals basically running, criminal elite running the politics now in most of the Western world. For example, we had an expose over the last week or so on Channel 4 News here in Britain about the Conservatives spending up to 2.5 times what the maximum legal amount is on their by-elections and at the general election in some key seats. So they're just breaking the law with impunity now. It's a bit like kind of, you know, Pinochet-style politics, where there is nobody seems to have the guts, the courage, none of the Crown prosecutors to stand up to these people because they're so well-financed and they've got more powerful lawyers. This is one of the things that was happening at Scotland Yard. I mean, I don't know much about the FBI, but I know a bit about over here, is where even the Chief Constable of London couldn't sack crooked detectives who were dealing drugs because they had more money to pay lawyers than he did. So that's where we're going, I'm afraid. You mentioned Cuba briefly there. If you don't mind, I'll just pick up on something.
Please.
I picked up from Cuba. It's because I noticed with the UN panel on Julian Assange talking about arbitrary detention. Now, arbitrary detention is something that arbitrary governments do. This is something which has been a little phrase used over here in Britain really since the 17th century to describe what happens when governments start to basically drop the rule of law, a bit like Watergate over there, you know, where the Secret Services start to think, well, actually, why don't we start interfering in domestic politics and, you know, maybe assassinate somebody from a rival political party we don't like, you know, that kind of thing, like John F. Kennedy, for example, or his brother, you know. So once you start going down that road, you've got some really serious problems. And arbitrary detention of Julian Assange is one of those. What's been pointed out by the Swedish Doctors Committee for Human Rights is that Anna Ardin, who was the woman who's accusing him of rape, was actually an employee of the Swedish embassy in the Swedish diplomatic service. So she's basically, potentially anyway, a spy. She's working for the Swedish government. They've also pointed out that she was kicked out of Cuba because the Cuban government said she was working for the CIA over in Cuba and not for the Swedish government. So the Cubans have given a very strong sign that the woman who's accused Assange of rape is actually, a CIA operative. There's a lot of evidence also that the other woman with Anna, not quite sure of her name. There's two of them. I think it's Sophia Willen, that she's very closely connected. Her family is part of the Swedish police as well. So, there's a lot of double talk over what really happened there. If anyone hasn't already watched it, I suggest your listeners have a look at the brilliant Australian ABC documentary, Sex, Lies and Julian Assange, which goes through in detail some of the things that real events that happened over in Sweden and why this is such an utterly disgusting bit of arbitrary detention that's taking place in London of Assange. And of course, the reason for that is he is without doubt the most important, the most powerful, radical independent publisher on the planet. And he's publishing all sorts of lies and double dealing by our own secret services, by our own diplomatic services, where they're being paid by us to commit war crimes, and they're lying to our faces about what they're doing. So he has been pointing out the kinds of Watergate types, the bad guys within the secret services and within our diplomatic services, embarrassing them. And so what have they done? Well, they're trying to stop the publication. Well, this is a kind of old story, isn't it? From, you know, centuries back, all despots have wanted to try and stop people publishing books, broadcasting, making documentaries, this sort of thing. And this is what Assange has been doing, you know, and WikiLeaks, absolute superheroes, in my view. The guy who deserves a knighthood, you know.
Everybody out there, I want to be really clear on this, because a lot of people on our side of the pond in the United States are dismissive of Julian Assange. They don't they treat him like he's I don't understand it. I have to say there's a lot of contempt for him here, Tony. I have tremendous admiration for Julian Assange.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
And he is a whistleblower. He is paying a terrible price. How dare they try to keep him locked up in an embassy? You know, the one thing I would say is that he should come out. Has he, you know, why? Because I'll tell you something. I read somewhere that the statute of limitations on the rape charges had expired.
Stop, Susan. There have been no rape charges, right? There's an accusation of rape. That is it. I could accuse you of rape. You can accuse me of rape. It doesn't mean anything unless there's some evidence and then there's some charges. And if he's not, they haven't actually got any evidence to charge the guy. All there is lies about a rape being circulated by the media. That is it. There's nothing more. He hasn't been charged with anything.
Okay, he is. That's right. Tell everybody. Let's back up and tell them that story so that we all know exactly what they've done and what they haven't done.
Well, okay. So Assange was over doing a talk in Sweden, and he had consensual sex with two different women. The first woman then was pictures taken of her with her arm around him the day after. And then he went out of the country. And it's only after he left the country that apparently that there was some kind of accusation of rape against him. So, I mean, the whole thing was a total setup. She's even tweeting, as you'll see.
Hold on. And I want to interject here. The idea of rape in Sweden is very silly. What they said was that this woman, I think she should be ashamed of herself. She should be deeply embarrassed and horrified. If I were her, I'd be so embarrassed. Apparently they had sex, consensual sex, and a condom broke. Now, men, women, ladies, when you have sex, that does happen. It does. Reality, let's be grown-ups, let's be adults. Condoms break during sex. That is not the man's fault. It is not the woman's fault. It is the nature of the act. I mean, how preposterous. And then this woman was like, got all hysterical, and I would be, and again, if she was here right in my living room, I'd slap her. I'd say, you silly goose. Oh, I might have AIDS. Well, 5 years later, did you come down with HIV? No, you didn't. So how can you possibly be prosecuting this man for something that clearly never happened? You were hysterical, this lady was hysterical, and she had been on television. She had been, the paparazzi was chasing her. Oh, you're with Julian Assange. Oh, yes, we had sex. Oh, and our condom broke. I wonder if I have AIDS. Oh, dear, you know, it's this celebrity hunting stupidity, hysteria of, I'm going to get attention. I'm going to get my name in the newspaper. And then it goes out of, it's just wacko.
Okay. It's just another couple of tidbits for you here from Sweden. The night after, apparently she was raped, Anna Ardin tweeted, it's okay, Julian can stay with me again tonight, she tweeted. On a text message. And then again, a text message saying, I'm sitting outdoors at 2 a.m. and hardly freezing with the world's coolest, smartest people. It's amazing. And that's when she had a picture taken with her arm round Assange, apparently the night after he'd raped her. So this is just completely manufactured, and it's only a crooked, corrupt media that can allow such utter nonsense to be peddled as fact. It's not fact, and they are scared to death of what WikiLeaks might be publishing next. That's the real reason for this, because they
okay,
are
okay. Let me ask you this question: why doesn't he just come out of there, come out of the embassy, and say, "Okay, lady,
okay,
did you get AIDS or not?"
No, you didn't. Very, very simple answer. And there's more legal opinions in Britain this week have confirmed this, that if he does go back to gets extradited, as would happen immediately back to Sweden, from Sweden, almost certainly he will then be extradited to the US. And once he's in the US, it will be another Bradley Manning, basically. He'll be behind bars for the rest of his life. Of course, Edward Snowden was pretty smart. You know, he made sure he was well out of the way before he gave his leaks. And that has effectively told us how you do these kinds of things. If you've got criminal evidence against our criminal elite, make sure you don't just simply go to one of our newspapers in this part of the world. You have to get out, really, of this part of the world before you can blow the whistle, because otherwise you'll end up like Chelsea Manning, Bradley Manning, you know, just behind bars. And that's why Julian is so worried. And I think, actually, I've got a little idea for him here. How about this? Why doesn't he come out every Friday morning, Friday evening, Friday night, just as all the revelers are sort of getting drunk in London after a week's work, and give a whole bunch of leaks to the public from the balcony, you know, kind of speech where, hey, this
great
is
idea.
This guy.
Great idea.
This is what I've heard, found out this week, because WikiLeaks is actually the most important radical publisher on the planet. Just go onto their site right now. You'll find every week they've got more and more. They've got a brilliant thing called the Kissinger Files, which is loads and loads of leaked, crooked cables by Kissinger over the years, this multi-super criminal who's in charge of the Bilderbergers right now and planning World War III as we speak, you know, the guy behind the coup, the bloody coup which led to hundreds of thousands of people dying in Indonesia, behind the invasion, Turkish invasion of Cyprus, planned that, also, of course, in Chile. Tens of thousands have disappeared in Chile. This maniac is still given the time of day by the BBC. He should be behind bars. And Julian Assange has published a massive amount of his crookery over the years. Done a fantastic job on that. So the Cubans helped us out, really. If you go down deep enough, you can see the Cubans have made it absolutely clear. Don't trust the word of these crooked. What they've done, the Swedish doctor's report, which you can find online, it's the Swedish Doctors Committee for Human Rights, is they've done a really good job in unwinding loads of stuff behind the Assange thing in Sweden and saying, well, look, the main people who have been accusing Assange, both within the government and outside and in the ex-diplomatic service, are those who have also utterly compromised Sweden's neutrality. That's why they're so annoyed with these people, because they want Sweden to be able to be, you know, trusted by all sides, both sides, anybody, to arbitrate in international disputes. And these are the sorts of people who've made that impossible, that made that Swedish neutrality is, and Carl Bildt, people like that, for example, who've made Swedish neutrality just simply, no more than skin deep. Of course, they're part of the New World Order, the West, you know, the British, the Americans, and NATO and the Bilderbergs. That's, I think, really significant. The other significant thing, because we're coming near the end, Susan, I really want to squeeze in, is this report by the Argentinian doctors about the Zika virus.
Yes.
Because this, I think, is one of the most significant things I've seen, and it shows you just how inadequate our mainstream press is. I mean, I used to work for the BBC, you know, things like the IRA bombing campaign in London many years ago. But it seems pretty clear that these Argentinian doctors have done their homework on the Zika virus and on the hideous birth deformities that it's been causing. And what they've done is show that it's actually, yeah, they believe anyway, linked to this Monsanto type of Roundup kind of pesticide. Mycoencephaly, they say, okay, here's the headline. Doctors name Monsanto's larvicide, that's L-A-R-V-I-C-I-D-E, larvicide, as the cause of Brazilian microencephaly outbreak. They're just basically linking up the use of a lot of this Monsanto chemical in the areas where the microencephaly has been happening to it. So that, I mean, I'm not saying that's a fact. I can't prove it.
But that is a fascinating revelation. It's the Monsanto. So wait a minute. So the Monsanto larvicide, which should be killing off the, oh my God, because what they're doing is, as they're trying to kill off the mosquitoes, they're using the very Monsanto spray, which is then causing the abnormalities.
Yeah, the poison is called prepoxifen, and it's used in state control program aimed at eradicating the Zika virus. It could be that the misguided science that's led to an attempt to get rid of Zika is actually making things worse. All I say is I don't know that this. I'm not a scientist.
But it's all motivated by the big pharma, you know, big GMO push.
Yeah.
That's fascinating that we have created this. I mean, Zika's terrifying. I mean, as a woman, I tell you, Zika's terrifying.
Well, it's a kind of birth control type thing, isn't it? It's all eugenics. You know, this is
full
of eugenics. But look, the problem here is we haven't had this actually very credible reported at all here in the West, and it hasn't been looked at by our press. They just take one look at it and think, oh, some sort of conspiracy theory. No, this is at the Argentinian doctors basically like their trade union, you know, that's come up with this report. So you know, it just seems maybe that they're scared of being sued by Monsanto, Susan. It might be that simple. But I want to see our press have the courage to report all the possible aspects of this and to just be honest with us and not to back away just because they think, oh, there's a big powerful corporation, we better not upset them, which is what most of our mainstream press nowadays act like.
Wow. Well, what about the World Cup? Or excuse me, the Olympics?
Well,
I mean, the Olympics in Brazil, I mean, they may have to even cancel that. I think that this is actually very serious. I mean, they're saying it can even spread through sexual contact.
Well, look, the great thing about the Olympics and the World Cup, actually, is that it brings all nations together, doesn't it? Particularly the Russians. We're looking at the next World Cup. That the next World Cup is due in Russia? Or is it I'm not quite sure. But all I can tell you is that there has been a great deal of time and effort put into demonizing the Russians from FIFA and demonizing the Russians from the global athletics. What this tells me is that the war party is winning and they want to make sure that there is no kind of cultural contact between East and West in the future. What they call Chris Mulligan, who runs CTRL, Conspiracy Theory Research List over there, calls hardening the sides. It's a sure sign there's a war coming when any kind of friendly contact between sides, for example, through sport, is prohibited. And that's what we've been getting, I think, in the internet, FIFA, World Football, and also in the International Athletics Federation, demonizing the Russians. I put my arm out to the Russians and my hand out to the Russians. I think that they are showing a great examples of diplomacy around the world. They don't seem to want to fight anybody except ISIS and destroy this monstrous propaganda tool of the West. That's the way I see ISIS anyway. And, you know, basically supplied by Turkey, part of NATO. And Turkey is going downhill fast because of it's being used by the NATO countries as a way of getting at the Russians, as a way of getting at Syria, getting at the territory, which is, I mean, even as a school child, Susan, I can remember we were discussing, oh, well, Syria, when World War III starts, it's bound to be Syria. This is the place because, of course, it was where East meets West in so many ways. And it looks as if that may be happening. I don't want to be a doom and gloom merchant, but you just got to be realistic. When you see these kinds of attacks on sport, then it is a sign that there is a deliberate plan not to have a fight against ISIS in Syria, but to have a fight for Syria. It's not about a war in Syria, it's a war for Syria. I think the world's got to understand that.
Very, 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 very interesting. Yes. And that's also the part about the point about Iran. You know, they're saying Saudi Arabia's worried. There's talk. There's gossip. Saudi Arabia, it's supported by the CIA, that Saudi Arabia is gearing up to launch 150,000 Arab soldiers to Syria. They're mobilizing for Syria. Have you?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm also, you know, it's really tearful what's been going on in Yemen. Of course, the Saudis actually a large part of the Saudi army is recruited in Yemen, but it seems that they don't mind attacking Yemen as a result of it all. We've had something like 8,000 civilian deaths now over the last nearly a year of the Saudi attack on Yemen. This is one of the most important, oldest civilizations on the planet. It's just being smashed to pieces. 25,000 injured, people starving. The British helping with the targeting, the British helping supplying parts and supplying the planes and supplying the bombs to bomb. I mean, I just feel absolutely appalled that this is being allowed to go on in the modern world. It just shows me, again, I'm afraid it's a sort of endorsement of this idea that we've got a criminal elite. And I don't think our ordinary governments have really got much power anymore. I think it's the banks, the banksters, the big corporations, the nexus of the Bilderberg really controlling our, you know, basically big business deciding who are going to be potential politicians to run our affairs. And of course, the whole Bilderberg conference was based on, if you look at Lord Carrington, who was the chairman of the Bilderberg for many years, you look at Prince Bernhard, the former SS officer who was chairman for many years. This is a kind of pact done, I think, just before the end of the Second World War between the US, the British and the Nazis in order to create their own kind of financial, very powerful covert network behind the scenes to control politics and to keep the earth and its industries for themselves and not to let the rest of us have a share of it. And they've been very active ever since as a very powerful political lobby. I think it's going to be the Bilderberg conference in the US this May, June, Susan, so you've got that to look forward to.
Yeah, well, I tell you, 2016 is going to be a hot year in America. Tony Gosling, thank you so much for joining us today. Everybody, we'll see you next week. Tony, thank you very much.
Thanks, Susan. We're online at thisweek.org.uk.
Thank you. Thank you very much.